From KCRW, this is Greater LA. I'm Steve Chiotakis with a show that connects you to the people and places of Southern California. Under the rocky, snow-covered peaks of the Sierra Nevada mountains lies a dusty scar of a dark time in American history. The former Manzanar internment camp sits among the desert brush about 3 hours north of LA. It's usually pretty quiet here. This past weekend, about 1,000 people converged here for the annual Manzanar pilgrimage. UCLA's Kyoto Taiko drummers help set the tone as people walk in with flags that list the names of the 10 incarceration camps around the United States, which held about 120,000 Japanese Americans during World War II. This was one of them. Reporter Susan Vallett sat watching on the dusty ground, listening as the names and sizes of the camps were read aloud.
Jerome, Arkansas, 8,497. Manzanar, California, 11,070.
Back in 1942, just a couple of months after the bombing of Pearl Harbor, President Franklin D. Roosevelt forced Japanese Americans from the West Coast into desolate camps like Manzanar. Many of those U.S. citizens lost their homes and businesses. One of those families came from Terminal Island in San Pedro. Toyo Yamashina was about two at the time. Her dad was a fisherman.
Most of them had their own little boats, fishing boats, and they would go out in the morning and then come back with their haul. And then there's a cannery there. Whenever the fish came in, they would ring a bell, and then all the women would go and, I guess, clean the fish.
Obviously, Yamashina was a baby at the time, so she just knows the stories others told her about life then and the day when everything changed. On December 7th, 1941, the Japanese bombed Pearl Harbor. The fishermen of Terminal Island had left in the morning, and by afternoon, the government had ordered them all back to shore. Those fishermen, including Yamashina's dad, were detained and sent to Montana. Then, a couple of months later, the Japanese Americans living on Terminal Island were given 48 hours to get out. They were eventually sent to internment camps. Yamashina, her mom, and her sister ended up in Manzanar, where they were eventually reunited with her dad. Yamashina says before they left, her mom and about 10 other families had put their belongings into storage in Whittier.
And during that time they were in Manzanar, they got word that there was a fire and they lost everything, all their belongings in there. They were pretty sure that it was set on fire. People took things out first.
Yamashina believes it was arson because there were belongings removed before the place burned down. She was only a toddler at the time, but remembers bits and pieces about living in Manzanar.
I remember the dust storms, and I remember the public bathrooms. It was really public.
Meaning there were no partitions between toilets. The family ended up in a tar paper covered barrack here. Yamashina hasn't been back here since, until this day at the pilgrimage. She says she's driven by many times, but didn't feel much when she saw it from a distance.
And no, not until I got here to this and I saw the barracks. Then I got emotional. But, it's great what they're doing here and, you know, preserving history and keeping it going because these are now the younger generation.
Yamashina is on this pilgrimage today because of a group photo in the visitor center that she's in. It shows her as a child sitting next to a little girl wearing the same dress that her mom had made. She wants to find out what happened to that little girl. They were both among the 11,000 Japanese Americans forced to live behind the barbed wire in the harsh conditions of Manzanar. So was Mei Kagayama Kakahashi, who turns 100 later this month. She had just graduated from Venice High School when she was sent by bus to Manzanar, not knowing where she was going.
I was 18, 19 years old, so I didn't know what's going on in the world. I thought we were going to Japan. See, they took all of us in a bus, we're all Japanese. I said, gee, who are they going to take us to, Japan? In Japan, we were at war with them already, you know, and why do they want us over there?
Kakahashi says she had many emotions as she set out on her first big trip.
I was mixed, feeling bewildered, wondering, yet it was sort of a little adventure because I never driven out of Los Angeles.
Kakahashi ended up getting a job doing stenography at the hospital in Manzanar and got married there. And she tends to focus on the more positive memories, like when security at the camp started to ease up a bit in its later years.
The truck driver from the warehouse took us, all of us, hospital secretary and steno, onto the truck, and we went to the foot of the Mount Whitney area and play in the snow. And then we got caught, and then we had to go back. But we had a ball. It was nice. Freedom for a few hours.
Kakahashi left the camp when her husband got a job in Chicago, eventually returning to California after the war. Masako Kami Hollowell is also in that same group photo that Toyo Yamashina is in. In fact, they met by chance for the first time at this year's pilgrimage in front of that photo and now plan to go to lunch. Hollowell has come back to Manzanar before, but this year she came to the pilgrimage with a couple of friends to celebrate her 80th birthday. Hollowell says she doesn't remember much about living here, and her parents, who were originally from Glendale, really didn't talk about it.
They remembered the happy occasions, the friends they made and stuff.
But they did tell Hollowell about the day she was born in the camp. Hollowell's family lost their grocery store in Eagle Rock. She says they made do with what they could find. She says her mother was very creative.
She took some old orange crates that she saw, and she built me a high chair.
Hollowell and the others are here for lots of different personal reasons, but all of them center on remembering what happened here. Bruce Embry's mother helped to organize the first official Manzanar pilgrimage in 1969.
The Manzanar pilgrimage gives life to this notion that there's a power of place. It's an extremely powerful place to be. You can sense its history. It's a solemn place. It's a sometimes difficult place to be. We have turned one of America's most shameful moments, a site that was, in essence, a negation of American democracy, into a site of justice, of social justice, and actually was able to create a site that was not just one of shame, but one of accomplishment and of celebration as well.
Some worry something like this could happen again. Since the start of the pandemic in 2020, there have been 11,000 incidents of anti-Asian hate reported nationwide to the AAPI Equity Alliance. But former internee Mei Kagayama Kakahashi says this community won't let something like this happen again.
It won't happen to us anymore. We know better. We're going to fight. Can't do that to us, American citizen Japanese.
For KCRW, I'm Susan Vallett.
Manzanar, we come to pay our respects. Manzanar, we won't forget how a people's rights and freedoms were taken away. Land of the free.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
Onward now with Greater LA, and may the 4th be... I'm not going to do that to you today. You've heard that enough, I'm sure. But it is time to talk about space, particularly the sounds of space.
3, 2, 1, boosters in ignition, and liftoff of Artemis 1.
All right, all right. That's the beginning sound of going into space, a rocket blasting off. How about this sound? That's the inside of a spaceship, like what Luke Skywalker or Captain Kirk would hear as it travels through the final frontier. But what does space really sound like, and why is it important to know? The short answer is what's making those sounds can affect everything from satellites to power infrastructure to animal behavior, which is why scientists at NASA have spent more than a decade and a half tracking it. And scientists at UCLA are asking for your help in identifying it. Emmanuel Masongsong is a program manager at UCLA's Space Institute. Mike Hardinger is principal investigator of the HARP Community Science Project. Thanks to you both for coming on.
It's really great to be here. Thank you.
Thanks for having us.
Mike, I'm going to start with you, and I will ask you that question, that very profound question. Why is it important to know what space sounds like?
Well, the space sounds can tell us a lot about what's happening in the near space environment. And that kind of stuff, the magnetic fields and the plasma or charged particles in near space, affects human life and technology.
Near space is around Earth, right?
Yep, right around the Earth. You know, we're talking maybe 100 miles to 1,000 to 10,000, 100,000 miles up out in
altitude. Where the satellites are and things like that.
Exactly. And this kind of stuff that we're studying can affect those satellites. It can affect the telecommunication satellites. It can affect internet. It can create electrical currents in our power grid. So we really want to understand what's going on up there.
Is it, Emmanuel, when you go into space, you know, if you were able to take your space suit off, right, and just fly right out there, right, what would you hear? You probably wouldn't hear anything, right?
Yep, that's right. We can't hear magnetic vibrations, but we can use special instruments, even a compass. If you had your compass on you and you took your helmet off, first of all, if you survived,
you would die.
But the compass would pick up vibrations in space. And so that's essentially what we're doing, is measuring vibrations just like you would measure vibrations in the air. So we're translating those magnetic vibrations into sonic vibrations within the range of human hearing.
And that's the thrust, no pun intended, of this of this project, right?
Exactly. Yeah. We need people's help to basically pick out patterns in these magnetic vibrations. You can think about these vibrations kind of like musical instruments. There's a bunch of different instruments all playing at the same time and all retuning at the same time. And people are really helping us make sense of those complex patterns.
So give me a little background, Mike, on this project. What does HARP stand for? What exactly is the project asking you to do?
Right. So HARP stands for Heliophysics Audified Resonances in Plasmas. We love our acronyms.
Just rolls right off the tongue.
Rolls right off the tongue. But there's really a meaning to it, because there's a massive magnetic HARP right here in the near space environment. And it has to do with the Earth's magnetic field lines. So if you move away from the Earth, the magnetic field gets longer and longer. And it's kind of like a harp. The strings get longer and longer as you move along the harp. And you can actually hear that in the satellite measurements. You can hear the pitch change, just like the pitch would change on a harp. And so we're asking people to listen to our data and pick out the harp, basically the harp sound.
Emmanuel, I'm not a scientist. I don't even play one on the radio, thank God. But why solicit my help for this? What, you know, or the help of other non-scientists? What can we give you?
It's a great question. So there's one of our collaborators, Robert Alexander, has done some research on how the ear can pick up patterns very basically instinctively, even without any training. And so pairing that with the visuals and the context of what we're looking for, we found that just everyday people can listen to these sounds, hear things, hear different patterns. So there's truth that anybody can do this. And there's so much data. There's over a decade worth of data that if we used computers, it wouldn't be able to find some of the things that the human ear can pick up.
So what we want to do is now go into a different place in the building. I think it's time to hear some of these sounds that we're speaking of. And let's head over to Mission Control here at KCRW, which is AKA our performance studio. And let's give a listen, shall we? Let's go. All right. So here we are, Mission Control in our performance space. And Phil, if you wouldn't mind, let's play this sound because we want to identify these sounds. This is normal harp, an example of a normal harp.
So what you're hearing is a NASA satellite flying away from the Earth on its orbit up to an altitude of about 50,000 miles and then coming back to the Earth. And as it's flying through this massive magnetic harp. And the pitch of the harp gets lower as it gets away from the Earth. So that whistle sound that's going down and then back up is basically the satellite flying out to the end of the harp where the magnetic strings are long, and then back to the Earth where the strings are short and the pitch is lower.
It's like digging through something.
Yep, yep. And a lot of that background static and noise you're hearing is the solar, what we call the solar wind. The sun is constantly blowing this stream of charged particles and magnetic fields, and it's constantly blasting the Earth in different ways. that's creating that background noise, but it's also creating that harp sound, that pitch that you're hearing.
All right, there's also something that you sent us called the reverse harp. So let's listen to that, Phil. Okay, that sounds like it's in reverse. Obviously, it sounds like it's sort of inverted. Is that what's going on, Emmanuel?
Yeah, the way that the waves behave around our planet, we're still trying to understand them. So this is something that was unexpected. And so for our citizen scientists to pick this out and mention, hey, we heard this, but it doesn't really fit the model, that's exactly what we're trying to do, is for people to pick up what they hear and let us know, because we might have missed it.
Why is it important to distinguish that?
Well, the way that we understand the near-Earth environment is through these vibrations. And so the end goal would be to better model that using computer simulations so we can predict when the solar wind might be affecting our satellites. Or now that we're sending astronauts to the moon, they might get bombarded by blasts of solar wind, which is actually particle radiation. And so understanding this environment is actually really important for our future in space. This overall field is called space weather, and it's the effects of the sun and the solar wind on our environment. So the more satellites, the more launches, the more astronauts, space tourists we put into space, we need to understand that environment so that we can make sure that those things are safe.
Are the northern lights sort of the visual aspect of what we're listening to?
Yes, absolutely. Solar flares are visible, the northern lights are visible, but everything in between is invisible. And so that's why we need to use these magnetic vibrations, almost like sonar, how you can pick up things underwater using vibrations. So we're doing the same thing, but with magnetic fields, so we can understand space weather better.
Phil, one more, and this is called multiple harps. Let's hear that. So, Mike, is this a combination of normal and reverse?
It's a lot of things happening, actually. And this is what people will experience if they use our user interface. It's three orbits of the Themis satellite. And most of it is, I would call it the normal harp, but there's lots of other stuff going on. You heard lots of static and blasts in there. And so this is, again, where we might find some reverse harps in there, we might find some normal harps in there, and we might find some other patterns that we weren't expecting. And so this is exactly what we need people's help to do, is to listen to that kind of sound clip and help us pick out these patterns in the sound.
Emmanuel, what are the real-world ramifications of having this information? I mean, how does it help us right here at home?
It's a great question. A lot of people ask this, and I believe that space weather research is one of the more practical forms of space research, because our technology can be impacted by solar wind and solar storms, and then even us on the ground, our power systems are vulnerable because of these long transmission lines. They can pick up magnetic vibrations in space and actually overcharge power stations. This happened in 1989. It's happened multiple times in the recent history, but we haven't seen a big one, so to speak. So understanding how this process works will help us prepare and or predict it.
And by the way, you can get involved in this by identifying these sounds. There's the HARP website that we'll have a link at our website, kcrw.com/GLA. Emmanuel Masongsong, Mike Hardinger, thanks so much for introducing us to these sounds and for coming here and bringing them to us. We appreciate it.
Thanks for listening with us.
Thanks so much for having us.
More now of Greater LA on KCRW. I'm Steve Chiotakis. As long as humans have been communicating, they've been telling stories. It's been a part of human culture since the beginning of time. We use storytelling to connect, to record history, to learn. One group here in LA is using it to help.
You know, my mother used to say, always look for the helpers. Anybody who is coming into a place where there's a tragedy. Oh, baby, I can find a little help for my pain. All I need is my brother. Because if you look for the helpers, you'll know that there's hope.
Young Storytellers is a group that brings mentors and volunteers into schools to help kids from elementary school to high school be the driving force in their own narrative. Jaylene Bengen Chung is the Development and Communications Director. She's with us today to tell us more about Young Storytellers and what they're up to. Hi, Jaylene.
Hi.
Tell us a little bit more about what y'all are doing, how you began and the market. I was going to say the market that you serve.
Yeah, well, we started as very basically four volunteers from American Film Institute in like 1997. were responding to arts education being cut from schools. And so they started with one classroom, helping students in a classroom write stories, whatever they wanted to write. And then they brought actors to that school to perform the stories for the kids and their friends and their families. And that's basically the same program that you see today. We're in schools all across Los Angeles and some schools nationwide. And these kids just basically get to see their stories brought to life by professional adults and have adults listen to whatever they want to talk about.
So you're training like future screenwriters and playwriters, right?
Not necessarily.
it sounds like a Jaylene. That's what it sounds like.
it does sound that way, but you know, we really encourage our students to use storytelling in all forms of their lives. You know, a lot of these students are selected for our program by their teachers because they're not necessarily the stars of their class. They're on the they're shy. They're on the spectrum. They have some learning differences, and so through this program, they really get to see that their voices matter and that they can be more self-confident in what they have to say.
What makes a good story, Jaylene? Like, how do you put together a good story?
Well, aside from the basics of story structure and the, you know, everything that we see in movies and television, there's really the identity of the writer that is poured into the story. I think what's really cool about our program is that a lot of the stories that our kids write are so universal that a lot of the themes have stayed the same for the past 25 years. You know, it's about friendship, about family, of wanting to find people that they can fit in with, all the way to like candy that talks and dogs that talk. Mm. And they're all ideas that the adult mentors relate to as well, because they're like, I remember writing stories like that when I was that age.
So how exactly does a story go from a kid's imagination to being staged, you know, to making that performance aspect of it?
Yeah, so we have a curriculum that we've developed over the years, and we have a group of mentors in the classroom. They're all led by a head mentor who are amazing volunteers. They're almost like, they're basically teachers, and they lead the entire class through the program, and the kids don't have to do any actual physical writing themselves. They tell their stories to the mentors, and the mentors write them down. And the mentors have to learn screenplay format. But then at the end, they have a 5-page screenplay. And then we print those out and get fabulous volunteer actors to come and perform them. And it's very magical.
So what is a child who's gone through this program take away from it? I mean, do you see the graduates moving into screenwriting, as I mentioned, or playwriting, or how does all that work? Or is it just a better way to tell stories going forward?
Yeah, I think it's both of those things that you said. Some of our students have gone on to write plays and work in the film industry, but some of them, you know, are carpenters or are working in, you know, regular everyday fields, and not that everything outside of Hollywood is regular, but
well, I mean, the thing about storytelling is that we all do it all the time. Like yes. We do it as a radio station, but you know, there are so many people who, I mean, just even telling your friend about, you know, the date you had last night, that's a story. I mean, it's in our everyday DNA, is it not?
Exactly. I think, you know, what we really see is that the way when we tell stories to each other about ourselves, we really get to connect more and to see each other as people and to be better empathizers. And that's really what we want for our students is for them to advocate for themselves and just be advocates for their communities, and so that they can make the world a better place around them.
Well, it's a very cool program. I want to thank you for coming on and talking with us. And maybe some of your graduates going forward will hear on KCRW one day.
That would be amazing. We'd love that.
Jaylene Bengen-Chung from Young Storytellers here in L.A. Jaylene, thanks for coming on.
Thank you.
That's going to do it for us today. Tell us what's on your mind. Share a story idea with us, too, at our website, kcrw.com/GLA. And grab the podcast while you're there. We'd love to be in your podcast lineup. Juliana Mayo, Zoe Matthew, Sonia Geis, Ray Guarna, Phil Richards, John Connolly, Amy Ta, Carlos Ramirez, Sue Margulies, and Christian Bordall all help put the show together this evening. I'm Steve Chiatakis. Have a great night.